and Consumer Affairs, and committee the first bill on our work session, House Bill 2076, I'm going to carry over to next week. It's not ready to go yet. And with that, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2062. And Janet, can you get us back up to speed on it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2062 was heard in this committee on January 19th. And just a reminder that this is some cleanup language and further changes to a bill that passed last session that permitted the Insurance Pool Governing Board to contract for and to offer health benefit plans to certain small employers who are not otherwise eligible for subsidies under the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. You've probably seen in the paper over the last week some information on those programs that are beginning up in a month or so. The bill needed some amendments, and the agency has worked with the providers and of the two providers that have signed up to do these programs, and so the agency is here to explain the amendments, and one of the providers is represented as well if there's any questions for them. You have at your place today -1 amendments, again, that came as work between the agency and the providers. The -1 amendment has a fiscal impact statement, and Katie has hand engrossed the changes into the bill. So that's the, it looks like a bill that says hand engrossed up in the top right hand corner in your information, so you can see where the changes come.
Do we have that?
I think it was routed yesterday in the packet, but we can get copies.
Maybe it's in my folder.
That's 26. Yeah, we got a routing.
Yeah.
I don't plan on framing that.
There it is. That's it. Okay.
I love what you said.
So, Mr. Chair, again, some of the changes deal with the assessment that is going to be placed on the carriers. That effective date of the assessment is not until next year because the contract has already been signed with the providers. So. The agency is here to go through what the amendments are.
Okay, they on the sign-up list? And
this is the work session.
Okay. Rocky, would you come forward, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board. If you recall, when we had House Bill 2062 before you, there were some questions of clarification raised by various stakeholders, including independent contractors, as well as the two health insurance carriers, Health Net and Regents, with some of the language, not the policy, but just kind of how the language read. So we have met with them, and basically the -1 amendments, we think, then meet all the concerns that they've raised. And in my testimony here, I'll kind of go through them just briefly with you so you know what we did. Under the definitions, the first thing we did was to restore independent contractor back to its original status that was in the bill prior to the 2062 proposal. And that basically excludes independent contractors under the definition of an employee. We also do that under the definition of a small employer to exclude independent contractor under that definition. And that was an issue raised by the independent contractors to make sure we restored that to what it had previously been. The second is that we have clarified through the carriers who would be an eligible employee to be consistent with the CHI, that small employer health insurance definitions and regulations. Basically, we've added who have been employed by the employer for a period of time established by the employer or for fewer than 90 days. Our old statute said if somebody was coming into the employer, they had to wait 90 days before they could get health insurance. And what we wanted to make sure is that no 90 days, they at the end of 90 days, they could get health insurance, as it is throughout the small employer market. You can only keep somebody who's eligible for the first 90 days, kind of a probationary period. So we wanted to be consistent with the small employer health insurance market. The definition of family member, we also adjusted to include any other dependents eligible under the terms of the health benefit plans elected by the employee's employer. That would be consistent with the small employer health insurance definition. So carriers have, through their contracting process, the ability to identify who, in addition to normal family members, spouse, unmarried children, etc., could be included in their policy. And again, that is consistent with the other 2 million people in the commercial market. Under 735, 720, this was not a change, but we wanted to, if you recall, change the definition from recipient to an applicant's family in looking at income. Under covered class of employees, we are withdrawing that piece from the original House Bill 2062. And basically, after discussion with both Health Net and Regents, they felt that by adding offer a health benefit plan to fewer than the employee's total number of employees, by having that in there, it would allow some adverse selection. So we are going to remove that reference, which means that the carriers will do nothing more than follow what is the normal regulations under small employer health insurance. That is, they can divide classes between management and non-management, but they can't exclude a class. That's under current regulations. So you could provide a different health benefit package to managers or non-managers, but what we wanted to make sure didn't happen because of adverse selection is they provided just to the non-managers, but nothing to the managers, or something to the managers and nothing to the non-managers. So we've completely excluded the reference in our statutes to class of employees. Then it'll just fall under the normal insurance regulations. Under temporary assessment, we wanted to make sure a couple things. First of all, that the language was specific to the assessment applying to plans sold by the certified carriers under the small employer health insurance program and not their general book of business. So if Regents has 20,000 small employers, but only three of those are through the IPGB certified plans, the assessment built into the premium only really applies to those three employers. It isn't against the general market. And further, they wanted to make sure that the assessment was levied equally against each carrier participating, and finally that it was against earned premiums as opposed to just premiums. And that's a definitional issue with insurance companies in how they describe premiums. Program policy recommendation is one change or addition. As we went through this process, there was some discussion as to who makes the decisions about the policies and program. And prior to when we first established the program in 1997, the IPGB was really just focused at that point on FEOP and not all the certified plans and a variety of other programs that we're doing. And thus, some of the authority for deciding about the rules and the programs was vested with the Office of Health Plan Policy, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, who is the current administrator of that. Since that time, we've got a federal waiver. We've reopened the certified plan program beginning this year, March of this year, as well as the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. So what this does is basically takes the Office of Health Plan Policy out of the role of making the decision on specific programs and policies we administer, but assures that we will continue to consult with them as well as the Department of Human Resources. And that's related to the federal waiver program. In the last page, this is not a change, but it was an issue that was raised relative to House Bill 2064 about further clarification of the definition of residency. As a part of the federal Medicaid demonstration, the requirements allow the Insurance Pool Governing Board to use federal matching funds only for U.S. citizens and non-citizens who meet specific federal qualifications. And they're called qualified and non-qualified citizens. In order to establish the eligibility criteria that met these federal qualifications under the waiver that we worked with the legislature and Department of Human Services in in 2002 to do, we made changes to our administrative rules. But during the rule review process, the Attorney General raised questions whether current statute allowed us to restrict program eligibility beyond just a resident requirement. So what we've tried to do, and what it says is, eligible individual means an individual who is a resident of the state of Oregon, and it defines resident to mean anyone who lawfully resides in Oregon, regardless of citizenship. IPGB wants the ability to further restrict residents who are not U.S. citizens and who do not meet U.S. federal qualifications under the Medicaid waiver demonstration. The proposed language that was drafted by Legislative Council and our Attorney General's office would achieve this. If we don't change this, the current language does expose the agency to a lawsuit that, if it were to prevail, could require FEOP to serve populations unintended by the legislature or included under the waiver. So that was kind of an explanation of why we tried to give some different authority to the board in defining that residency. It was not to expand the eligibility. It really is to be able to give the board the authority to fit their definition of resident within the confines of the federal waiver that we have to get federal funds. So that's kind of a quick summary, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rocky. Just again, for the record, and for my understanding, that this last amendment and last change actually makes it more restrictive, would give the board the opportunity to be more restrictive as opposed to being opening it up for to broaden the eligibility.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. King, I was curious about the 90-day effective date for the insurance. I'm curious that after termination, does the employee get 90 extra days of insurance?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Holve, no, but what they do become eligible for is state portability, state continuation, or if it's a larger employer above 20, COBRA coverage. So they have that continuation. But employers in this state have the ability, when they hire somebody, to say, as a condition of your employment, well, the state of Oregon is a good example of this, your health benefits do not start until 30 days. And all employers have that same right under the regulations to establish a period of time before someone becomes eligible for health care benefits. What we want to say here is, and what it says, is no employer can set that date more than 90 days, which is consistent with what the entire employer-based market does. That means they can set it at 30 days, 60 days, or 90 days. But they can't, as our previous statute said, automatically say you can't get it for the first 90 days. And that's what we're trying to get out of.
Follow. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the employer is not making premium payments on that employee during that first 90 days, potentially, is what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, that is correct. I again want to say 90 days is the limit. It's a lot of employees as a part of that hiring somebody will start the health benefits immediately. Some have a probationary period for 60 days, but it can be no more than 90 days.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rocky, sorry I didn't have a chance to talk to this question, give you this question when we were talking in the hall, but I'm interested in the change of the date from to March 1st, 2006. Is that going to allow the Regents and Health Net to delay their payment into the assessment process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, we, as you know, we're implementing this March 1st. So the contracts have already been agreed to and the pricing structure and the benefits for the first year of operation. Because we did not have statutory authority, no allowance is built into those for any assessment to take place and until the next contract period, which would start March of 2006.
Okay, so it's not going to affect the dollar amounts that the insurance companies pay.
It's not into effect, and it's also, Representative Shields, something that would have to be a part of the RFP and contract negotiations. We cannot impose that assessment unilaterally. It is basically an agreed to, but no more than what the statute allows us to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any other questions? Thank you, Rocky, for your testimony this morning. Yeah, Janet.
I just wanted to point out that we did pass out a letter that says House Bill 2064 on it. And that is in a response to the bill that was re-referred to committee yesterday from the floor to explain that that sentence that was questioned on the floor yesterday. I don't think it was ever referred to publicly, but several of you were talking about it. And that's so this isn't the bill we're talking about today, but the same sentence is in the bill we're talking about today, and it's on page 5 in the bill, lines 13 through 15. I just want to make sure that you know that the same issue is involved in House Bill 2062 and the definition of resident.
Okay, the chair would entertain a motion to adopt the dash ones.
I'll move we adopt the dash one.
Right. Representative Schaffner moves we adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2062. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, they are adopted. Committee's decision on 2062 as amended.
I move we...
It goes to Ways and Means.
Send House Bill 2062 to Ways and Means as amended.
Representative Schaffler moves that House Bill 2062 as amended be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Do you like a recommendation?
With the do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shields.
Yeah, I'm going to vote for 2062 and the amendments. I think it is good for small business, a good stepping stone. As I mentioned previously, Better People, the organization I started back in 1998, used it as a stepping stone with HealthNet to get into a full HMO plan. And at a time when methamphetamine abuse has reached critical importance, and since methamphetamine abuse is often associated with workplace, people who are trying to be super workers, super moms, and super dads all at the same time. I just look forward to working with the providers and with Rocky over the long term to seeing if there's a way that we can put drug and alcohol treatment into the program.
Thank you, Representative. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
Representative
Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kiss.
Excuse.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative
Shields.
Aye.
Chair Brown. Aye. Motion carries. I want to open a public hearing on House Bill 2288. Janet, can you give us a rundown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2288 has to do with possessory liens and the distribution of the proceeds of a possessory lien sale to state that the proceeds will be distributed to junior lien holders and security interest holders after the possessory lien is satisfied, and that commitment is paid, the junior lien or security interest holder will be paid, and then the proceeds would go to the county to be held for 3 years for the owner or the previous owner to be able to claim the remainder of the proceeds. This was brought to the legislature by the Oregon State Bar and will be represented in the first person to vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. That's David Hersher. Mm-hmm. David Hersher, please.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Mm-hmm.
Good morning, sir.
Thank you. It's my first opportunity to appear in front of any legislative committee, so excuse me if I'm nervous. I'm here today on behalf of my colleague and partner, John Casey Mills, who was not able to attend. He was the person who initially brought this matter to the attention of the debtor-creditor section and its legislative committee. It's actually a not a very complicated matter. Our assumption is that when the statute was originally drafted, the drafter simply didn't consider the possibility that there would be surplus proceeds. We have examples in other areas of law, such as foreclosure of consensual security interests under the Uniform Commercial Code and foreclosure of mortgages, where the law clearly provides that any surplus proceeds after payment of the senior lien creditor being foreclosed then go to junior liens before they go to the owner. This simply makes this possessory lien statute consistent with those other areas of law. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any question?
Yeah. Just explain to me exactly who's getting what here.
Well,
in layman's terms.
An example would be a situation where, let's see, a good example would be a car repair operation where the automobile is subject to a consensual lien, bank financing on the title, and the car is taken to a repair shop. And the repair shop would have a first lien if it's not paid by the owner for its repair services. But if it sells the car and there's a surplus after paying the repair shop's first lien, then under current law, it would go to the county and the county would give it to the lien debtor without any opportunity for the bank on the title to come in and say, we're entitled to that surplus. We may be second, but we're in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And this would simply assure that there's a mechanism for that second lien creditor to say, we get the surplus before it goes to the lien debtor.
Hold on.
So just so I get this straight, I got a car, I take it in to get it fixed, or whatever, and I can't pay the repair guy. He sells it off to get his money. Then that money, whatever's left over, goes to the county. And if I'm an unscrupulous deadbeat, I get the money instead of the bank who I owe the money to, correct?
Chair
and
Brown,
this would say that, no, the bank gets their money, not me, the deadbeat.
That's correct, Chair Brown, Representative Chair.
It
simply respects the legal priority of the security interests.
I'm with you. Just for the record, Mr. Chair, I'm not a deadbeat.
And so the mechanics lien then would be senior to a bank that already made a loan on the vehicle before?
Yes, Chair Brown, that's current law.
I prefer the term financial.
That's not being changed.
Okay. Interesting. I run the shop and I didn't know that. And I don't know how there could be any other liens on it, but a third lien on there, where would it fall in order?
Well, this, as amended, in other areas of law and as amended here, there could be three or more liens, and they would each be, they would fall in line in order of priority. It's an unusual situation that there are surplus proceeds, but if there are, they would flow in what we call a waterfall down from the possessory lien creditor into each of the subordinate lien creditors in their legal priority.
And then to the
and then if there was any remaining surplus
to the
lien debtor, that's correct,
yeah.
Chair Brown.
Okay, can fees be charged on that all the way through? Huh?
I apologize that I haven't prepared for that particular answer, but I can say that the statutory amendment we're talking about would not affect that. It doesn't create or remove any right to fees. So, whatever right to fees there are, would remain. Or there is none. None is created. I apologize for not knowing that answer. I could find out and report to you later if you'd like.
Okay, please.
Thank you.
Representative Schaffler.
And the nice people that provide financing, they're okay with this concept.
Well, yeah. I specifically haven't talked to any banks, but they're the ones who are directly benefited by the proposal.
May I follow up?
Representative Schaffler.
I just want to thank those generous folks for being so concerned about the tradespeople that repair our automobiles and trucks in the state. Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Janet?
Mr. Chair, I just want to point out to the committee that the payment of reasonable and necessary expenses of the sale even come before the lien holder, and that's on page 2, line 42.
Thank you, Janet. That clarifies that question. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on House Bill 2288? And Tim shakes his head no. Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing and open a session on House Bill 2288.
Ready to move it?
It goes, it has a referral to judiciary. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2288 be moved to judiciary with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves that House Bill 2288 be sent to the House Committee on Judiciary with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Gilman.
Yes.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kidd.
Excuse.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Steele.
Aye.
Representative
Escobar.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2160. Janet, can you give us a rundown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2160 was pre-session filed by the Department of Consumer and Business Services and would allow insurance companies to issue more than one class of insurance in a package insurance policy if the director determines that the issuance of such a policy is in the best interest of the public and would result in either efficiencies of acquisition or administration. According to the insurance division, current law unnecessarily restricts insurance companies' ability to group different lines of coverage under single policies. Some of those are pretty common and would not involve any kind of conflict of interest or anything. The bill also clarifies that an insurance company may permit the holders of certain types of policies to borrow on those policies, and the insurance division is here to explain what those kinds of policies are. And finally, the bill deletes a requirement that DCBS publish an annual report containing a number of items because those things are currently available online or in other forms that are easier for the public to access anyway. Mr. Chair, there is a dash one amendment, and it should be in your packet, and the insurance division can explain the purpose of that amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Carl Lundberg. Good morning,
Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carl Lundberg. I'm here, the Deputy Insurance Administrator for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Our Administrator, Joel Aria, wasn't able to come today because his wife just had a baby a couple days ago. I'm here today because I'd like to get your support for the House Bill 2160. Our proposal includes four technical changes. The first one repeals the statutory requirement that the Director publish an annual report on the Insurance Division and the enforcement of the Insurance Code. The second one deletes an obsolete exemption from the statutory prohibition against the transaction of life insurance on a mutual assessment plan. The third one clarifies the applicable law governing the extent to which an insurer may combine classes of insurance in package insurance policies. And the fourth one adds specific statutory authority allowing insurers of individual annuities to permit holders of individual annuities to borrow upon them. Regarding the first proposal, the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services is currently required to prepare an annual report of the Director's official transactions under the Insurance Code. We do not believe that report now serves any useful purpose. The same information is continually available on an updated basis in real time on the Division's website. The statement of the Division's expenses is better expressed currently in the Department's budget document. There should really be no or very little effect on the insurers or the insurance buying public or other stakeholders because the information that has been in the annual report is readily available on the web and by other means. The second is the statutory prohibition against transacting life insurance upon a mutual assessment plan that contains an exemption for insurers that were transacting credit life insurance before September 2, 1963. This exemption is obsolete because there are no entities now authorized in this state, and its removal will therefore affect no insurers. Under the mutual assessment plan, a life insurance policyholder is subject to assessment to pay losses. Since we don't have any of those entities, there's no policyholders, it's just not necessary to have that provision anymore. Under current law, insurers, on the third provision, the current law allows insurers, policyholders of individual life insurance policies and certificate holders of group life insurance policies and group annuities to borrow upon the coverage. Insurers are permitted to allow individuals to borrow upon their individual annuities, but the statutory authority to do so is not as precise as it could be, and we would like to make this authority clear. The fourth has been some question about whether the current laws governing package insurance policies unduly restrict the flexibility of insurance companies to group different lines of coverage together under a single policy when that is appropriate. Package policies in common use include homeowners and business owners' coverage. This proposed change would enable the division to review and approve package coverages like travel policies. We propose an amendment to the proposed change relating to package policies to further clarify its purpose. This bill streamlines regulation because it eliminates obsolete provisions and clarifies some that are unclear. I request the committee's support for House Bill 2160 with the proposed amendment, and that the amended bill be passed to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. Are there any questions that I could answer for you with regards to this bill?
There must be some questions. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What you're saying is historically there's been a division between the various lines of insurance, business, and home. That's one example. That's all right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, we have property and health lines, and for example, so you can't combine a health line with a property line. So if you have a homeowner's policy and a commercial policy, those are both in the same line, the property, and so they can be combined, and they are. But if you have like a travel policy that might have health and cancellation and lost baggage and so forth, you're mixing different lines of insurance, and then you can't put the policy together. So that's what this bill would do, is enable the director to approve those kinds of policies which combine different lines like health and property, so that the insurance buying public can have those available if they want to buy them.
So what you're saying is that health insurance companies through this change would then be able to provide general liability and other types of insurance?
Not if they're licensed, didn't allow. They still have to be licensed for whatever line that they're going to be doing business in. But they would be able to package, if they wanted to put together a package that included trip insurance, they could put that together if they wanted to as a specific policy. But to general liability, they would still have, they'd have to be licensed as a to carry that particular line, and the health insurer wouldn't be license to provide general liability insurance.
Is this a good deal for the consumer?
Yes, it's a good deal for the consumer because it makes products available that might not be available now, and new products as the insurers are continually trying to meet the needs of consumers. It enables them to continue to innovate with their products and gives the director the ability to determine whether they're fair for the consumer and approve them.
Any other questions? Representative Holden.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yeah, I kind of like that package coverage deal. It seems like a good point. But under your item number three, I have a question about the ability of policyholders to borrow on the coverage.
Yes.
Does that ever endanger the beneficiary of the policyholder having that insurance policy used as leverage?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holdy, I think the answer to that would be yes, but it's the beneficiary who owns the annuity product and makes the decision that they want to borrow against that product. What this does is makes it clear that if they want to be able to borrow against that product, for their personal reasons that they're able to do that. And it's not clear that they're able to do that now. So when they buy an annuity, is an asset, and it gives them the ability to use that asset currently if they have a need to use it for some personal reason. So it's an advantage to the consumer, and only is operative if the consumer takes it. And what this does is makes it clear that the individual, if they seek to do that, that they can actually borrow the money against their annuity. So you have like a pure endowment policy is a type of a policy that pays off when you live a certain period of time or for a certain period of years, and it's not clear under the statutes that you could borrow against that policy today, but this amendment would make it clear, this bill would make it clear that if an individual wanted to borrow, they could. It's just like the law has been changed on retirement accounts and so forth, and people borrow against those. Of course, they may have to pay tax on some of that, depending on whatever, but the public has generally taken the position that they want to be able to control their assets and decide whether or not how they're going to use them, which may also include borrowing.
Follow, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I understand that, and I don't really have an issue with an individual being able to borrow against their policy. But I guess my question is more directed at a group policy holder that's like an employer holding a group policy for a lot of different individuals. Does this enable that policy holder, being the employer, to borrow against the whole policy that really the employees are the beneficiary of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, no, it does not. This would just be to the individual certificate holder.
That's what I was getting at. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there any other?
I have one question.
Representative Salford.
So if I go out and just the specific beneficiary of these policies can go out and borrow. So if my child inherited or was given a policy that would provide her with an annuity after she came of age, okay, I couldn't go out and borrow against that, could I?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, we know
good.
That could not.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions?
No, sir.
Thank you for your testimony. And there's no one else signed up, so we'll close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2160. We have some -1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to 2160.
Representative Gilman moves the -1 amendments to 2160. Is there any objection? Seeing none, they are adopted. The committee's pleasure. Representative Esquivel.
We want to take a floor.
Representative Esquivel moves House
Bill. Move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2160 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
Representative Holtby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Excuse.
Representative Chalmers.
Aye.
Representative
Hughes. Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
Consent calendar, Mr. Chair, or you want
to? I'm almost scared of consent calendars anymore. Do I have a carrier? I volunteer. Everybody leans back. I'm sure Mr. Lundberg would be more than glad to help you with the floor speech. Representative Shields, would you?
Poor Chip.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, I think I still need some more work on feeling comfortable with the issue about the package coverage, so I'd prefer to perhaps take the next one.
Okay. Any volunteers?
No, I'll take it.
It looks like he's looking at me.
I volunteer Representative Holvey.
Representative Holvey will carry it. Then. And
isn't that the way you volunteer?
Carl, I'm certain you'll be willing to help him with it. Yeah, they'll be in contact with you, Representative.
Can I talk to you?
Thank you. Is there anything else, Janet?
No, Mr. Chair.
The speaker has said that we can have a couple of meetings out of the building and around the state in different areas if we care to do that. And I was thinking I'd like to maybe have one in the Portland area and have Bowlby, the labor and industry folks come and talk to us about their agendas and tell us about their department, and maybe at the same time have a visit to one of the apprenticeship schools up there if it's possible.
Bowlby?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. What do you think? Would that be?
Yeah, I like that idea.
As long as we're back in time for session.
The next day?
Yeah, the next day.
Okay, we'll get that one set up then, and then be thinking about another one someplace that we can have around some other location. Okay, is there anything else? Then, Representative Kitts would...
Oh,
we had a couple of measures.
It's all good. Thank you, though.
Okay. We are adjourned.